I am Adrien Garcia, entrepreneur, designer, and co-founder of the clothing brand Rayoni. And you are listening to The Bold Way. The future belongs to those who question the established order. But how do you reinvent the rules, create iconic projects, and work that will make history? The Bold Way is the podcast that gets into the minds of those who excel in the field. Fashion, entertainment, food, design, art, or business. Their common points? Hard work, boldness, innovation, and a particular focus on creativity and aesthetics. My mission is to dissect their methods and mindset through long and filtered interviews to give you the keys to their success and inspire you to create your own path. The Bold Way is more than just a podcast. It's a movement that encourages everyone to find their own way, carve their own path, and innovate in their field. The Bold Way is where creativity and innovation meets business. Enjoy the episode. Believe it or not, 75% of you haven't subscribed to the podcast on platforms like Apple Podcasts or Spotify yet. If you are enjoying the podcast, I would really appreciate if you could subscribe using your favorite listening app. Your subscription truly supports the growth of the podcast. The more subscribers we have, the higher the quality of the guests we can bring on. Thank you so much in advance. Hello, everybody. Thank you for listening to The Bold Way. Today, I am with Eric Torstensen. This is right, yeah. I said it
sounds
right.
Sounds better with French accent.
I'm looking forward to your French accent as well, because you just told me that you have a French accent when you are in France, in Paris. So to begin with, just to put a bit of context, where are we today, Eric?
Well, today we are at the Ritz.
Yeah.
You kindly came to my hotel room in Paris, which is very nice. We're very fortunate. And we're waiting for the room service to arrive, yeah, to interrupt us.
Listen, this is my very first time at the Ritz. That's ridiculous,
really?
Yeah?
That is ridiculous.
Yes.
I mean, it's the best place in Paris.
Yeah, definitely. Why you come to the Ritz, by the way?
Several reasons. They're very nice to me here because we have a collaboration with them. So
that.
I feel like I know people here and it's nice, and the owner is a friend and everything. And I like, in general, I like institutions, restaurants, hotels. I don't like the new and trendy and all that. So I, of course, it's a privilege to have the chance to stay here, which I recognize and understand, but I always like institutions.
Okay.
And service is amazing. And when I'm here, I do back-to-back meetings, as I said earlier, and everyone is easy to get everyone to come here.
Of course.
And it's central. So
that's a good reason. My second question is, who are you? And how do you present yourself to the world when they ask you, who are you, Eric?
Oh my God. That's a good question. And it has always been a little bit of a problem.
Yeah.
But I guess work-wise, well, I am the co-founder. My job is now the co-founder and creative director of Frame, which is a Los Angeles-based brand, 10 years old, 11 years old this year. But overall, it takes longer sometimes to explain all the facets of what I actually do. But I guess creative director is a good... I guess I'm a creative director.
Yeah, creative director.
Yeah.
Of course, it sounds good, and yeah, it sounds very exciting and sexy, isn't it? today, listen, I want to really understand how you made it from a farm in Sweden to New York City. You took over New York City a few years ago. Not really, but I mean, you made a big business in New York City, so at least we can say that you made it in New York.
It's a long journey.
Yeah, it's a long journey. So yeah. How did everything start? Can you tell me about your childhood?
Yeah, I can. It was very happy childhood. I grew up, as you mentioned, in a farm, an hour and a half outside Stockholm in Sweden. Very simple, very easy. I mean, easy, but you know, simple. I have fantastic parents. Saying that, I think I was always a bit different, or I felt different there. Because it's very traditional, you know, everyone does the same thing, you know, you play soccer, you know, and when everyone played soccer, I did dancing and skateboarding.
Dancing?
Yeah, I was a competitive dancer.
Yeah.
I don't know, my parents signed me up at some point and then I liked it, and it was competitive swing dance, and this became like a big thing. I was Swedish junior champion twice even.
Wow.
No, I did like 5 days a week for many, many years.
Mm. And did it shape you?
Sorry?
Did it shape you?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was... I mean, one of his good exercises, creative, and it was intuitive, and I loved it. And just like skateboarding, which is very similar to you know, any kind of creative profession, is it a kind of individual, but you do it with other people. And, I was so untalented at skateboarding, so bad. But this led me into what I actually later did with graphic design, because to hang out with the cool guys, I started taking pictures of them and I draw logos and stuff. It was a way of being part of the
cool kids. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And of course, it wasn't a big skateboarding scene on the farm where I come from. So it was also like, I wasn't set up for success, really, to be fair. But so I was there, and even my mom said, if I didn't know where you came from, I think you were adopted, because I was very different to my family.
Okay. Do you have brothers and sisters?
No. Only child. Also, my mother said that it was you were so much that we couldn't handle another one.
We stopped.
It was very intense. Because on a farm, if you have my personality, and because, you know, I was born 78, there was no internet, there was no cable television, there was not so much to do.
But were you helping in the farm?
Yeah. I can drive a tractor, I can,
It was a pig farm, right?
Yeah, pig farm and, fields and stuff, but I had zero interest. And even my dad said, whatever you do, do not continue with this farm life. You know, he had to take over the farm from his father, and he said, don't do that. It's not the best life.
What you were dreaming about?
I mean, I was dreaming of being a skateboard pro, but that didn't work out at all. and I guess I was just dreaming of I was dreaming a lot, because one of the greatest things of my childhood was boredom. And now no one is bored, but I was bored a lot. And boredom then, I think, gives birth to creativity. Mm. You have to come up with stuff, make things, or all this kind of stuff. But I was dreaming of going places, seeing things, you know, going to Stockholm or traveling or experiencing things. And then when I got a hold of magazines, which again, this is a while ago, it wasn't so easy, but I remember, this is seminal for me. I got a hold of an issue of Arena On Plus a long time ago, and it was, I think the headline was The King of Magazines, and it had a line on the cover, it was yellow. And I was like, my life changed. I saw, the typography, the reading, the pictures, everything. And then I became obsessed with magazines.
Okay.
The Face, Arena Plus, all this kind of stuff. I was starting to try to get a hold of it, which wasn't easy. And skateboard magazines. And so I collected them like crazy. And I would spend hours go through them and learn. Mm-hmm. So I started dreaming of that world and what that was. But again, there was no internet, no social media. So, you know, it was a very closed world. You didn't know where to get to. And then I found graphic design, kind of by coincidence, and became obsessed with that. And the Apple Mac, whatever it was, because I can't draw. I actually have no talents in a way. There's no natural gift. Mm. So the Mac was like its tool, a solution where I can make things. And I got very fascinated by that. And I became kind of unlocked. I was not good in school. Until I found this sort of media. I started in high school going to this thing called the media program. And there I had an amazing teacher that showed me Photoshop and cameras and stuff. And then everything became exciting for me. So all my grades went up, English, math, everything. But mainly I became obsessed with graphic design, typography. Okay. And I was so starved for information. I looked everywhere for everything all the time. Yeah, even on the summer break, I managed to borrow a Mac. We didn't have any money, so I borrow a Mac to have at home. I got the key to the school to go in after hours because I just wanted more.
Wow.
So that was a big, maybe when I was 16, it was a big unlock. I believe a lot in being unlocked.
16?
Yeah.
Unlocked?
Unlocked, okay. For sure. And then the dream of becoming a graphic designer started.
Okay. So what did you do to do that?
I did so many crazy things. I tried to learn everything day and night,
obsession.
And then, obsession. And then the internet, came with slow, and then trying to find out where it was and learn, try. And then, try to get work experience at ad agencies. I remember I wrote 200 handwritten letters to all the Swedish agencies. Did not get one reply. I was really passionate and read everything. I tried to go to Stockholm and get something. I even took I took a summer job with my then first girlfriend that was being a courier on rollerblades or inlines, roller skates, only because the interview to get the job was to get to go to an ad agency in Stockholm.
Wow.
So I didn't go actually for the job. I took the job. I did the job.
Okay.
But I went so I could go and see what an ad agency looked like. Mm. It's crazy.
That's crazy.
The shit you got to do,
But did you study something?
Yeah. So I went in that media program, and then I went, I managed to get a job. Also, again, it's like, this is not the, you know, not a cool agency or anything like that. It was one person who took a chance on me, which I'm really grateful for. There was a ad agency in Stockholm called Trendsetter, and there were two people. And I guess I was a good worker, but I was so proud. I got to work there a little freelance and literally designing like menus for corporate restaurants, but I was so proud and so happy. Took the train every day, an hour and a half up, hour down, bought a little suit. And I did that for a year and lived in a small town still. And then I applied to the school called RMI Bergs, which is like, I guess, St. Martin's or, you know, any kind of, it's like an ad
in
creative school in Stockholm for a 1 year magazine art direction course. Which I didn't think I was going to get into, but then I did, as the youngest one ever at the time, because I had this dream of being working for magazines.
Okay.
I got in and I went there again. You know, I couldn't get an apartment in Stockholm, so I took the train, you know, very late, worked hard. And that was amazing because you know, if you come from middle of nowhere, the older you get, the closer you get to similar minded people, and the closer you get to the excitement of what you want to do. So there I met some like minded people, but I also, I don't know, so a lot of the people that went there, I didn't find they were so ambitious. And for me, this was like life or death. I was like, I have to do this very seriously. So I studied there for a year, and that was magazine art direction. And then I was very lucky because it was another like seminal, like very important moment in at least in my career, was that at the time, a guy called Tyler Brule came to lecture at RMI Bergs at Wallpaper Magazine. And he liked Sweden and design and everything like that. And I didn't really know so much about wallpaper, but it was like at the peak.
It was at the top of his game, yeah. Wallpaper was at the top of his game.
It was super relevant.
Tyler is still at the top of the game, right?
Yeah, he's amazing. But it was really like, you know, kind of early days of wallpaper, and he was obsessed with Scandinavia and everything, and he came to lecture. I was very inspired by this because he talked about how brand developed and so forth. And I was working on a project that's going to be my final project that he liked a lot. The idea was to do, there was a talk show in Sweden. It was a bit like Jimmy Fallon or Letterman or something called Sen kväll med Luke. And that was like the place, like if Madonna come to Sweden, they would go on there. And it was kind of, it had a cool identity and it was kind of hip. So I thought this could be a good brand. So I had done a concept that was like the talk show should also have a magazine and it should have a merchandising and build it out and it should have more things to it. And he really liked that. So he like stayed in contact. And then I changed my mind weirdly on the way to my like final exhibition or whatever it's called. That was a terrible idea. The magazine that was named by the date it came out. Very bad idea. But what I learned in that was like, so then I tried to work with like photographers and stylists and commission and do things, and that was very exciting. But I did my final exhibition, and Tyler Brule then came, and this was very important, and he gave out some like grants or whatever you call like, you know, awards to people in the class. And he walked around, and you know, Tyler was a superstar. And I didn't get one. And I was so sad. I say, I worked so hard, like I wanted to go there, and I had also gone, which I forgot to say, but I went to do an internship at Wallpaper only for 2 weeks.
Okay.
Which was like amazing, but there was nothing else. But then he took me aside and he said, like, they got the rewards, but you got the job. And he said, you can move to London in 2 weeks and start working for Wink, my new agency.
Wow.
And I was like, I cried. I was like, you know.
You cried.
Like, you know, not in front of him, but I went to the street, big street in Stockholm. I screamed, but it was like all my dreams come true, you know. So I was extremely grateful. And it was just going to be for a few months to start with, but then it lasted 20 years in London. But I moved, and he gave me this chance. He had started something. It was called just Wink then, or Wink Media, I think. Now it's called Wink Creative, I think. Wink Creative,
yeah.
Yeah. And it was like two people there or something, and it was like Wallpaper was very popular.
It was the very beginning.
Yeah, very beginning. He had a couple of people, but, you know, we're getting clients via Wallpaper and stuff, and so grateful to him because he gave me this chance, and he really believed in young people and a super entrepreneurial, and I learned so much from him.
And what did you learn from Tyler and from Wink?
Well, I learned I think I had it, but like one was like to work hard. Like I worked like crazy. And this is like when people ask me like, what's the secret? Like, what's the advice to young people? I was like, well, work hard. Don't complain so much.
Yeah.
Work a bit harder. Be a bit nicer. Be a bit faster. Or, you know, it's no magic. It's just that, you know, I didn't take a day off for 7 years, you know. But I learned from him was to be one level of perfectionist, to entrepreneurial, seek new opportunities, and, you know, to understand brand and branding and how they can be explored and extended, and that the world is one place, you know, the global outlook, which is everything that he's about, I think, and to be unafraid of doing things, you know. I did things when I was very young, and also to believe in young people. Like, he really gave me incredible opportunities. Yeah, and I did things when I was so young that I was not supposed to do.
Yeah, how old were you?
19.
19.
Moved to London, 99.
Okay, and you were working for brands like?
No, but I mean, it was crazy. You know, I did like Stella McCartney's logo when I was like 20 years old when she launched. You know, that came, you know, we redesigned Swissair to Swiss. Of course, I was not the main
guy.
Yeah. Tyler was the guy, you know.
Mm.
But I was part of the team, and, you know, we redesigned Swiss. You know, I traveled the world. We went to this Kuwait fashion mall called Villa Moda. You know, we did ad campaigns for Time magazine. We did, I mean, so many things. And he really trusted young people. It was like going to a very good school, and you got paid, and you got to travel the world. Mm. And you learned from, like, an incredible leader. That was him. And it was amazing years. Amazing, amazing, amazing. But worked very, very hard.
Mm.
But it was all I did. You know, I went home to Sweden, finally going to have a break for Christmas. And he called, here's good news and bad news. I was like, okay, what's the bad news? You have to come to Switzerland tomorrow. I was like, but I'm going to be my parents for Christmas. He's like, the good news is that we've gone through to pitch for Swissair, the redesign, which was my dream. You know, I'm obsessed with Helvetica typography. So I, of course I went. So I learned, it's very good to work for someone, I think, that is like that accomplished, that knows that much, and he has a work ethic that is bar none. Like, he worked very hard, Tyler.
Mm-hmm.
And my idea was always, I don't leave the office until he leaves. And, you know, if I stay late, maybe there's a dinner or something, you be in context and you meet people. And I was all in. And it worked. It gave me great opportunities. He gave me great opportunities. It was an incredible, like, really formative time.
Mm.
And there was a lot of other amazing people there, you know?
So you stayed there for 4 years?
I think it was 4 years.
Yeah.
Maybe a little bit more.
So you left at 21, 22?
No, hang on. No, 23. I think I left when I was 23.
Yeah.
It's also where I met Jens, who, you know, has been my business partner forever. And him and I worked a lot together there. And then we had a shared dream, actually, which is a funny story. You know, we had a shared dream to work with. We wanted to work more in fashion. Wink was more like branding across many different things. Mm. And we wanted to work more in the world of fashion. We looked up to that and the magazines that were like that and the shoots. And so we actually, the first idea was to try to get a job with Fabian Baron or someone else in New York, right? Because New York had like the big agencies. There was Baron & Baron, there was Trey Laird and Partners, and Doug Lloyd, for example.
So Fabien Baron was at the top of his game in the
year. Yeah, and he was like...
I'm going to interview him soon.
He was my
idol. He's a rock star, yeah.
And I have also interviewed him for Industry Magazine, you know, the same as we talked about earlier before we started. So that was like the dream, to go and work for an agency like that. But we went to New York, and we had no connections. We were nobodies. I'm still a nobody. We really were nobodies. And Jens knew his PA or something through someone, maybe, but we couldn't even get a meeting. We got to like hand in our book, and then we got it back, and no meeting. And then we couldn't get any other meetings. And Jens, who's more brave than I am, and he got pissed. He's like, we can't get a meeting here. We start our own agency. And I was like, I don't dare to be so young. He said, no, come on, let's do it. So we sat at a restaurant in New York and decided to start Saturday. And then we went back, and then we worked on that a little bit, and then we left to set up Saturday. That was when we were 24.
Oh my goodness.
Which is
crazy.
It was so naive on so many levels, but naivety has really worked out for me many times, weirdly. Sometimes when you don't know, you do things differently, and it can be quite rewarding. So we left Wink and set up Saturday.
Okay.
And
what was your first client?
Well, for the first client, that was that we didn't have any clients. That was the problem. Because then you also learn, you know, here we were also spoiled. because, you know, we worked at Wink, and often also younger people, if you think you do everything, but it wasn't my clients. Yeah. It was Tyler's clients.
Yeah.
You know, and I saw it was easy at Wink, but it was easy because it was Tyler.
Yeah.
Of course. You know, he'd earned it. It's his. And then you wake up in the morning, Monday morning, and you have your own agency. And like, you know, I was nobody.
Called,
I have no
connection.
No one calls. You know, he was a superstar. We were, you know, two Swedish people in East London suddenly working out of an apartment. I really remember this because I was like, I want to work hard, like day and night. But like, you know, 3 o'clock, we had nothing to do. Yeah. But the very first client we did was for Liberty of London. We did it for free.
Okay.
It was a hustle. It was like nothing. It was like doing some PR boxes. We literally like packed them and did some graphic design and like a little shoot with Dan, Toby, and Smith. It was like a still life photographer. Ace is a still life photographer, but it was coming up, same generation. But it was great. And it was like young, and we worked out of an apartment that we were not allowed to work out of. And when it grew a little bit, we hired people. They tried to, you know, throw us out. And it was a great time. And then we had a break. It took a while and we almost ran out of money. There was time where we were like, this is not working. We need to go and look for jobs. The trajectory could have been very different. It was like a matter of weeks. But then Sweden saved us because we got a chance to pitch for H&M to do global advertising,
wow,
which is like a dream in a way. And we won this project and we did a campaign for that, and it was very successful for them. And then it sort of turned. It was unlocked again. It was like so close to not working out, and then it kind of happened. And then we, you know, H&M was a client for 10 years. And then you, as it in that industry, if I'm not in it anymore, but in that industry, how it works, you know, fashion is insecure. If you do one, you get another one and another one, because they, you know,
of course, you
can work with two competitors at the same time because they like what it is. So one thing led to another, and then Saturday, which is what's called, grew more and more. And it was great. And we did mostly like fashion, beauty, branding, art direction, campaign stuff. But then we figured out that, you know, at that time at least, like the big agencies, it was kind of a closed world. And at the time, people were quite snobby about digital.
Really?
You know? Yeah, people hadn't really, you know... Digital was like e-commerce with separate teams and brands and stuff. But we were like, okay, but digital should be what we, if we're younger, we're new, we have to understand this. We have to learn. So we, which sounds so weird. So we even started a separate agency called Wednesday at the time.
Wow.
That was like the digital agency. And then, you know, Jens, who's a super entrepreneur, also was like, well, we work with all these PR agencies. They tell us what to do, why we should own a PR agency, or, you know, we, and then we were like, we earn all these production budgets from shoots, from clients. We should have, then we give it to production companies. We should have the production company. And this is smart. And then we started building Saturday Group to have like separate companies that we owned together with founders or the people who run them. So they run them independently. We were part of the group.
And is this something usual?
I mean, I think it's happened more and more since, but traditionally at that time, it was not so usual. Because at one point, you know, the group was Saturday and Wednesday. It was something called Tomorrow, which is very big now. It's a showroom and, you know, distribution company, but now they own brands.
You were part of Tomorrow as well, yeah?
Yeah. They were part of Saturday Group. And then there was something called RMO. It was a PR agency. They did like all the shows in London, and it was amazing. And there was something called ITB, which is a talent company. So very early on dealt with, you know, big talent booking for big brands, but also like influencers and stuff. Yeah. And a production company called Ann Production. And then we had magazine, we had like publishing stuff, which is more for fun than anything else. But it was good because there's an ecosystem. You can help each other. You get one client, you can recommend, you know, they work with these other companies. So that was very good.
So it was different name, but everybody knows that it was part of the same group, right?
Exactly.
And if you could teach me how to build a good production company, a good PR company, a good agency, etc., what would you tell me?
I couldn't, because you have to ask the people who ran the production company and the PR company, and that is my point. It's like they're experts at that. Like I'm good at very few things.
You're good at what?
I don't know. No, but I know the older I get, the more you're like... You learn that what you're good at and what you're not. And I think, but I mean that I could not run a production company. You know, the person who founded that production company is very good at production, but maybe it was good for them to be part of a bigger picture when it comes to the back office and, you know, you're a bigger family, it's the mafia, right? In a way.
They're all Swedish, right?
No. No one is Swedish. Only Jens and me.
Okay.
I think, yeah, that's true. No, but I think, no, but if there's any lesson, I think where we were at the time, again, maybe naive is not what I should say, but kind of fearless. This goes for a long time. Or is reoccurring in, at least in my career. I think I said it earlier on, but we were not mic'd up, is that I actually don't have any like born talents. I'm actually not good at any one thing. It's the sum of all. This is why I do a lot of different things. The sum of all is hopefully something. And that's also, luckily enough, a lot about being a good creative director nowadays is the sum of all. It's not just one thing, it's many things, many touch points, you know. And I think we were not scared to start the agency when we were, you know, 23, which should be too young. Nowadays, maybe it's not, but at that time, it was very young. We were not scared to set up other companies, you know, around that agency. And in the same way, back in the day, when I started, if I was a graphic designer and art director, you know, people were really annoyed if you wanted to be a photographer as well. Right, because you stay in your lane at that time. Now it's different, but in that time, stay in your lane.
It's changed just a little bit now.
Yeah, but you know, it's funny because last night I ran into Anya Rubik, who's this amazing model, been around for some time, and we have done a lot of work together. And she was the first person I ever photographed. We talked about it last night because I said I had a client and didn't have the big production budget, but I said, like, why don't we, like, but we need a really good model. So you have to, you know, get Anya. And then that's the first time I took a picture. It's like, I just shoot it. I know it's not going to be like Steven myself, but Anya is so good that it's okay. And I always say, like, you don't have to like what I do, but I will do, right? And if you say I can't do, I will definitely do it. So when the industry says, oh, you're not supposed to take pictures, I will take pictures. And then when, you know, when I was art directing magazines, you know, I did it for a bit for Condé Nast, because like as an art director, you have an agency, it was good to have a magazine. You know, you're an art director, and I figured out, yeah, but we don't decide anything. It's the editor to decide everything. And this is not for ego. It's more like, I just want to learn and do and try. So then me and Jens were like, oh, but we'll start our own magazine then. Or we did it with a guy called Hugh, who's sort of Man About Town, where we could be editors and creative directors. And that was much more fun, because then we can tell the stories and control how it looked. And that was great. And then, you know, people said, oh, you shouldn't do that. But why not? You don't have to like it. It's okay. We're going to do it. And then we started an industry magazine, because they were like, you shouldn't start your own magazine. I said, well, why not? And the same was when, you know, when we started Frame, people said, like, well, you cannot start a fashion brand. You're not fashion designers or whatever. But why not?
Why people are saying that? I don't understand.
I don't know. But I think the fashion system is very built on people doing what they do, then defend their own sort of little thiefdoms almost. Which I hope isn't, I don't think it's the same anymore as much, but it was, I think people were afraid often. And I think it's also, people are good at different things. Listen, if I was like extraordinarily talented painter and I could just do that my whole life and be very consistent, I would have loved that. But it's just not my personality or who I am. So I have to lean into what I can do and what suits me. And maybe that didn't suit the system the way it was just set up anyway. And I also really believe that you have to evolve and change. Like, I don't want to be an ad guy when I'm 55, you know, like that's not, everything has its time. And I believe in chapters, every brand has chapters, your life has chapters. You have to like keep moving. Otherwise you very easily get stagnated. And I think, you know, I'm 45 now. I can see that with some, you know, people, if you don't move, it can also become very stagnated and sometimes boring.
But what is the right time to move when you get
every
bored?
Every 5 years.
Yeah, every 5 years.
You reinvent, I think.
This is what you've done, almost?
In a way.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think you need to be in a constant state of considering reinvention or at least evolution. No, yeah, that doesn't have to be revolution. But
yeah, it's like, yeah, evolution, not revolution, like starting a new project.
And then entertain yourself with things. I mean, even though I said earlier, I've done Frame for 10 years, but I also do other things, so I don't get bored with Frame anyway.
Of course. You're not good at doing only one thing.
No.
Yeah.
No, but this is, I mean, ADHD, it's a real thing, you know? And it's something that is like gives you superpowers on some levels, but also it can be very challenging to, you know, I have a terrible, I can do a whole podcast about what I'm really bad at. It'd be much easier for me, you know, follow through all this kind of stuff.
I would like to understand why you stopped Industry Magazine.
Oh yeah, this is very easy. We started because we were fans of the industry. And I think this, and I think I can speak for Jens as well, because we talked a lot about this, you know, coming from Sweden, you feel like an outsider. I like being the outsider. And I like to be, you know, I want to be the underdog. Then when you try harder, we used to say, in, you know, it's like we're number two, we're like Avis, number two, we try harder. Mm. There was a classic ad campaign. Avis, you know, Hertz was the big rental car company in America, and Avis was like, we're number two, so we try harder. I always loved that. And it's very much, I think, the Swedish mentality. Mm. And that's why you also have a lot of amazing brands and talent coming from Sweden.
Yeah.
But so we were fans. And again, I also think you should always be proud to admit what you are. You know, we were fans. We wanted to meet our heroes. We also wanted to, and we were curious, and we wanted to, we figured out that being editors, people in the fashion industry like editors, advertising guys, not so much. So if you're an editor, you're important, you know. So industry was a smart way to do that. So we started that to meet our heroes and all that. And that was great. Like, it was so much fun. And I loved it. And I even, you know, I designed it in this size so it didn't fit the scanner, so you couldn't go online. It was like, should be very slow. We didn't shoot current collections. We had no advertisers. I mean, it's only costs. But because we had the agency and the other companies, it was like a marketing cost.
Wow.
So yeah, I think it was smart for us, for profile, for everything. But we did it. And here's the other thing that I think is important to know. Just because you've done it and it was fun and good doesn't mean you have to do it forever. It had a time and a place. It was timing. It was the right time. You know, editors became stars. Was our first cover. We had Anna Wintour on the first cover. We didn't. I just bought a picture on Getty, retouched it.
Okay.
It was guerrilla style. But I then got a signed copy sent to me from her, going, well done, from Anna. I still have it. But we did 7 issues. And I think it's also if you have the energy. And at the last issue, both me and Jens, I remember us talking about that, who are we like curious about now? Like, what is we curious? And we didn't have any good ideas. And we'd met, you know, a lot of people. And it's like, maybe we don't have the energy or the ideas for this anymore. And at the same time, Instagram have come. So now everyone that was like an enigma in the industry that was hard to get to all became like a very accessible. Mm. People were posting, you know, I always tell the story, like we shot Marc Jacobs in drag in his closet. Mm. And suddenly he was posting pictures every day on Instagram. So what was exciting and exclusive that we could offer through the access we had with industry wasn't anymore. Mm. So therefore it had no point. And I also think we had lost interest a little bit and had, again, new interests. And there was Alexia and Elizabeth, who was like, were doing much, you know, all the work really for industry, you know, then they took off and did System Magazine that is amazing. Mm. And much better than industry ever was for what it is. And it's incredible the job they did there because they had the interest and maybe time to do it. And we needed to move on to our real business, you know. But so we stopped it for that reason. And
when do you know it's time to start, to stop?
I think when you're not excited
anymore. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, this is a luxury to be able, because it wasn't our job. So we could decide to stop, of course. Mm. It's different if anything else. But we always wanted to have a project that was like exciting and a bit more free. And so it's funny enough, like Frame replaced industry. The idea for Frame is never that it was going to work. We did Frame.
What's the genesis of Frame?
In the beginning, it was only we did it so we could Okay, so we sat in front of all these amazing founders and clients of ours. Like, you know, we worked with Remo Ruffino, Mr. Banano. We were, you know, creative ad guys. Like, we didn't know anything about product. We started Frame to learn about products so we could be better at being consultants at the agency, effectively. It was only one gene. And we had, you know, met a guy, Nico, in LA that could make jeans. You know, if you met someone that made cashmere, could have been cashmere. I don't know. It was like, there was no strategy.
Okay.
But Frame should not have worked. We used to say, like, it's incredible that it worked, even though it was, you know, we lived in London, we set it up in LA. You know, we had other jobs, so we did it anyway. It was Wild Wild West for a bit, for sure. It doesn't have a pure, you know, lineage in a way. Like, it was very random in many ways. and I see Framus in different chapters. And like the chapter one was like, we can make a pair of jeans, we can market it, and we sold it in wholesale. And that was it. But then it worked. And it was also luck and timing.
Why did it work?
I think it worked. I've been told afterwards that it was disruptive in the premium denim sector, but I didn't even know there was a premium denim sector or whatever it's called.
What was the market like at the time? Did you even make a market study? No, never.
Just make a pair of jeans. But I had an opinion about like what I thought it should be, and I asked a lot of people that surrounds us, like my girlfriend, the models, the stylists that we were working with. What do you want? What should it be?
But what you don't told us yet is that you worked. You set up Mr. Porter, right?
Mr. Porter. Yeah. Well. Yes.
So you knew about the market.
Yeah, I mean, we had worked with every client, in the world, and Net a Porter was a client, and whatnot.
Because what you don't say is a brand. At the end of the day, is you don't sell a product. You sell an image. You sell. Sexiness. I mean, what you want to become, right?
What I've learned is that it really starts with the product. And then you have to have an idea what everything else is for sure. But if you don't have the product, you got nothing to make sexy or make a world, right?
Of course.
And maybe before I did product, I thought it was just about the other stuff. And this, I think, was my mistake sometimes. But yeah, Mr. Porter, to answer your question, but that was, I mean, I cannot take so much credit for that. It was an idea I had that I took to Natalie and pitched, because after we had done GQ Style, Man About Town, I was like, yeah, I'm not the best at editing a men's fashion magazine because I don't care that much about men's fashion. I like men's style. But there was nowhere to buy this stuff online, so I had an idea about what it should be. And so we just took that idea to Net-a-Porter and to Natalie, and then they did it, bought it, and I worked day and night on that for a year and a half or 2 years. And we helped build the team and all of that. But, the company made it what it is, of course. We did the initial stuff, but it's an amazing project. Maybe, I think even in a career, you have like a few different things that were like my agency career days can probably be summed up to like the successes. Even if I did like 500 projects, like Justin Bieber and Calvin Klein, Mike Calvin's, that was like a good, that was like an important project. Mr. Porter was important. Industry was exciting. That's kind of what I remember. I don't know what else I did that was any good.
But in your whole agency career, I mean, in your whole career, actually, what has been the... I mean, I want to understand what have been the accelerators, the acts.
Yeah, that's a good question. But I don't know if there were so many accelerators. I've done this for a long time.
Yeah, that's it.
I think that being open to change, and I think in the agency days... mine and Jan's partnership, I think, was hugely important of, his constant strive to push forward to newness and fearlessness. I think it was very, very important. I mean, I could have also, I could have easily ended up just doing record sleeve designs for free for the rest of my life or whatever, it's like, I think that was a very important combination, the yin and yang, the balance between art and commerce and the interest in popular culture. The strive to always sort of renew and change and be fearless about it, I think it's important. Sometimes I think people are too, I come back to this a lot, but like a lot of people are very scared or like, I don't know why they are, but like to try or to do. A lot of people talk to me about like, oh, now I'm thinking about doing this, or maybe I will take this job, or maybe I will do it. So just do it. Nike is a big company, just do it. I think it's important to, No one is going to thank you for waiting. Ultimately, no one gives a shit.
Of course.
No one gives a shit about me or what I, you just have to do it, and then you have to question why you do it and how you do it. And this is easier said than done. I was also ultimately full of failures. But I think you have to try to do more and question what you do and then do again. And not be scared of failing. I mean, there's so many things that failed. But especially nowadays, like you move on. You do the next thing. It's okay. You don't hear so much about it. We started Frame and it went well. We started another brand that no one even remembers that was like failed so badly, called Grace. It was little black dresses. We did the whole show in London with like all these models and like it just wasn't good product. It failed. But we learned a lot from doing it. You know, so if we would have not done that, frame would not have been as good, or other things that maybe Jens work on would not have been as good. So it's like, it's important to do.
Mm. Do. It's your motto, right?
Yeah, in a way.
Before coming back to frame, I would like to understand how you pick your subject, I mean, your project. What drives you? And yes, I think this is two good questions. What drives you? What has been driving you good over question. The last 50 years? 45 years, sorry.
Well, I think the first few years was more about getting sleep and getting fed and getting changed.
Exactly.
But
yeah, just 30 years, yeah.
Yeah. But I think if you are innately creative, like you must create. Like that's, like I really like to see the result of having had an idea. I mean, the magic with creativity is, of course, it doesn't come from nowhere. It's like now they go talk a lot about AI. It's like, we are AI. It's like, I am everything I've seen, everything I've done. And then, you know, creativity is some kind of magic, some people think. I think projects kind of present themselves to you by trying different things. We've often had like many discussions about things here and there all the time, talking about new things. And then they kind of get sticky. Something gets sticky and feels right, and then it becomes something anyway. I mean, now I don't work on so many new projects, but I mean, I do separately to frame things for myself, but I don't know. It's like if you have excitement for it that can be enduring during some time, I think it's good. Often you try things and then maybe you lose interest. That is not a good project. But then, of course, if it's a brand or something like that, you have to look at, like, is there an opportunity? Is this realistic? Mm. Can one do it? You know?
Exactly what you've done for Frame.
Yeah. in a way. But that, again, started with something that was just a dream or something exciting, and then it becomes a real business, if you will.
Mm.
And then it, of course, also changes. The demands change and the challenges change and the opportunities change. But it's a constant set of change and opportunity and upgrade and try to do better. And ultimately, I mean, yeah, I want to do things that I'm proud of, ideally. And that's like what I'm like Frame now. Like the important thing for me is now to be proud of Frame and the creative execution of Frame. And
are you proud of Frame now?
I am very excited about where Frame is going to go. And I'm very proud of how we managed to get here. I'm proud of what the team is doing. I'm proud of, like, we have two new stores. Finally, the new store concept. I'm proud of them. I'm proud of some people that we hired. You know, these parts, yeah. But it's a marathon. And this is a good quote from someone else who I respect, not a Swede, who I respect massively, a friend of mine called Michael Schiller, who is the founder of one of the founders of Acne, who I know in a long time. And when we started Frame, because he knew me as an ad guy and because I'm so ADHD, he said, like, you're a very good sprinter, but are you ready for a marathon? Like, running a brand is a marathon. And he was right. It is a marathon, right? You know, when you have an agency and you work with clients, it's like you come and go, but here you stay. You build your own house.
Yeah.
And if you build a store that is not beautiful and correct, you know, it doesn't go away. So this is more of a, you know, it's a longer ongoing thing, and it has many challenges and many opportunities, but I've never been more excited about Frame than I am now, strangely. I was very excited in the beginning, and there was a wave of, I was also distracted and so forth, but where Frame is now with the team I have in place and with Nicolas Dreyfus as a CEO, is amazing, French, great partner, and I think we're it's good. This is very exciting.
You didn't reply to my question about the drive. Drives you? Yeah.
Well, the drive, I think, comes from...
I mean, what's quite amazing when we look at your career is it's the ambition, you know? How you manage to dream so big. I mean, it looks to be very ambitious. Do you feel you were ambitious enough, or...?
Yeah. It's a good question. I don't know. I was just, when I was unlocked when I was very young, I was very ambitious, but I was ambitious to, I didn't dream so big. I wish someone would have told me how to dream. I could how big I could dream, sorry, more. But because where I come from, it was more like just getting a job. It was like, I remember when I was, you know, when I was hired by Tyler to be a Wink, I was like, I'm done. This is like, this is world championship. Yeah. This is like, you know, when I was 20, you know, I wrote a list of what I wanted to achieve, actually, at one point. And when I was 25, I had done that. It was like we had our own agency. The end game was to have your own agency, and we had that. And I was like, I had a bit of a crisis because I couldn't dream bigger. I wish someone would have told me that one can do all these things if you work hard and stay focused and show up and so forth. But so, and then I think also like working with Jens helped a lot, you know, because he has an amazing drive and, you know, born the same year. Mm. Also, he was a skateboarder. Like to have, I think a key point is to have, not think you can do it all yourself. I mean, these kind of partnerships, I think, are extraordinarily important, depending on what type of character you are, I guess. But I think that's like a key factor. And I often say, again, if I try to give advice to someone, it's like to try to find someone that is very good at what you're not good at, you know? And I think that was hugely important in everything. Don't try to think that you know it all and all that stuff. Mm. Like it's not very productive, I think. Mm. And like not having such a big ego, and it's okay to be, you know, it's okay to share. It's okay to work with others and collaborate, be as collaborative as possible and so forth. For my type, and I think everyone is different. It's very personal, I think, what works for people. But the drive, I don't know. No, but I think there is a drive, but I think it's also like, I wanted to get somewhere and I want to experience things and I want to do things and I want to see new things. I get easily bored.
You have an exciting life, no?
Yeah, it has been and it's very exciting. And I think you kind of make it, I often think, like, you know, people I grew up with that stayed in the small town where I come from, I'm sure they're as happy as I am. It's just, you know, sometimes you go, oh, do you get to do all this and all that? But it's not for everyone. You know, it's like if you can be very happy with having a 9-to-5 job or whatever, I cannot do that. I don't think they could do what I do. And they would hate it. Some people I grew up with, you know, my parents would hate it. But for me, I didn't have a choice. It's just my personality. It's like, it's a gift and a curse, you know?
And what is the final destination? What's the
the afterlife?
No, what's the big picture? I mean, what's on your vision board, if you have a vision board?
I don't have a vision board, but I have, I mean, constantly evolving. And sometimes, you know, it goes in ebbs and flows in a way. I think I want to continue to evolve. And I mean, ultimately, the easy answer is I want to be happy. I want my family to be happy. I want to evolve. I want them to, you know, I'm very lucky that I have an amazing setup that way. And that's exciting. You know, it's like the private sort of, or the personal development of like having, you know, a good life in that way where you're happy and your kids are healthy and everyone is evolving and, you know, you have a good relationship and that, which I think I'm very lucky to have, which also takes work for sure. And then in a creative capacity or in a professional way, I think you have different stages or different chapters of your life, right? I think, you know, like when you're in your 20s, you're like, you learn your craft, you establish yourself, you work very, very hard. In your 30s, maybe this is not a science, of course, it's just a general sort of idea. And then, I mean, in your 30s, you reap some rewards of that and you establish yourself. And maybe in your 40s, you have some more options and you can reap the rewards maybe a little bit more. But then I have to think about the evolution of like, what is my 50s, what's my 60s, what's my 70s, and not be surprised by that if I last that long, which I hope I do. And I think that's also important because there's ageism in this industry and in many. And I think you have to like, again, keep moving. There's, as I said, like, I don't want to be a creative agency guy after 40. I didn't want to be, because it's a young man's or woman's game to do that. And you know, in my 40s, I think this is good, but you know, in my 50s, I should not be creative director of Frame either, or this should be different path. But so my ambition is to continuously evolve. And this other thing I do, you know, I invest in some companies and try to help them, or I do things for my personal creative outlet that is like now I make furniture sometimes or sculptures that I'm like flirting with that no one might ever see, but it's for me and it's rewarding, which is a luxury, but I don't know where that will take me or not. But I mean, now my focus is to be proud, making frame something that I'm proud of, more proud of, or, you know, and that is relevant to whoever we're talking to, our customer, and it's as simple and as that in a way. I want to see that through, and then I don't know, there's like, I don't know, I always want to keep evolving, but I don't think I will do another fashion brand, for example. I think this is the one, and that was the right time for that. Like, I couldn't start frame today. It'd be impossible.
Really?
Yeah. It wouldn't be possible to start this kind of brand. I think the market is very different.
What would you start today? No, you wouldn't go into the fashion brand business.
No. I don't think it's... I would happily help someone else like to do it. Maybe. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with the fashion industry where that is at. But to build to get to the size that we are now, for being me, where I am in my life, I think it would be hard. I think you have a certain sort of feeling and you're part of culture in a certain way at a certain age, maybe, or how you live your life. You know, my life now is, you know, I have a 6-year-old son, I have 2 stepdaughters, 18 and 24. You know, I do school run, like, you know, I'm not out and about. It's like, you know, when we started frame, it was the supermodel's jeans because, you know, I was on shoots all the time. These were my friends. I was like, that was my scene. We had industry magazine, whatever. There was a different context.
Yeah.
That was like a bit of the superpower of frame.
Context.
Yeah. And so I think it's different. Well, I don't know. I mean, I like frame. And you're going to make it good.
Okay, let's deep dive into frame. I really want to understand, the genesis, we talk a little bit about it, from making a pair of jeans and trying to sell it to what it is today. What is the size of frame today? I mean, you're quite a big brand now.
No, we're not a big brand. Frame does just below, I think it's been published, you can say just below $200 million. It's, you know, we have 15 stores, mainly US, 2 in London.
Who's your competitor?
Someone asked me this today, and I can never answer it, and I kind of don't want one. The way I see it, also depends, you know. Like,
I mean, what's your positioning? Maybe it's another way to ask it.
I mean, I think in America, no, but this is such a good question because you get put into a certain place by the industry.
Yeah.
And I never understood that. I didn't want to. That's what I said earlier. It's like we were a premium denim brand without understanding. I didn't understand that we were going to become one. And then in America, you become a contemporary fashion brand, they call it. And I never really understood that either. It's not how I saw it.
But where they put you at Le Bon Marché or at...
Yeah, then you'd be contemporary, exactly, fashion brand. But I don't want to be put in a... in a box, sorry. And it's the same as like with my personality. I don't want to be...
Don't put me in a box.
Exactly. So if I want to shoot a picture, I should shoot a picture. Like, it's okay. Or if now it's like, you know, I want to make furniture, people are going to be like, oh, you shouldn't do that. Whatever.
I really want to understand the difference, milestone to... I mean, 11 years ago, you start with a pair of jeans. You had a lot of assets with you, industry magazine, the agency, etc. But from a pair of jeans, you make $200 million, you know, 10 years after.
Yeah, but I mean, now we sell more ready-to-wear than jeans, which no one seems to know, but it's true. And I think that's... Yeah, it's important to do, like, you take momentum. We had a bit of momentum, and then you take that momentum to the next chapter. If you stop in that momentum, you start fading away. So,
what does it mean exactly?
No, but let's say, like, when we started frame, the momentum is selling denim, you know, to wholesalers, let's say, all these department stores. And if we have momentum in that, we have to take that momentum to then launch into ready-to-wear and to launch our own stores. Let's say if you don't take that momentum, it will go away. And this is what I talk about, always changing. So let's say now we've had momentum in America, but now we have more stores, we have a bigger e-com. Now we can elevate the brand. We can take that momentum to come to Europe and to Asia, for example, which we haven't done much. So like, that's the next chapter, in a way.
What are you excited at the moment?
AI.
AI. Why? What do you do with AI?
A lot.
Yeah.
A lot.
It's been groundbreaking for you?
Yeah. Completely.
But how do you use it on a daily basis?
A lot. I started when it's like DALL-E became publicly available in fall of 2022. And I guess the important thing is that I cannot speak to AI in a greater picture, right? You know, it might save or ruin the world, all that. I leave that to others. My use of AI is very basic. But as a creative director, I find it extraordinary. It's like a superpower. It's like you're Iron Man or something. And I think a lot of people don't understand the how you can use it in a smart way. And a lot of people think, oh, it's AI, so therefore it has no worth. I don't agree with this at all. For me, it's, you know, the output I get from AI is the same I've had for many, many, many years. You know, there was first you can draw, maybe, you know, when I started in this business, like the guy with the most books and references and magazines they could scan from and make a mood board, you know, had the good, you know, added your ideas, it became the project, right? And so you show a mood board and someone, you brief someone and make it. For me, how I've used AI is like I can train AI on my mood board or my ideas, and I feel like I can get more original ideas actually with that. And it's not automated. You know, I work on it back and forth, thousands of iterations, on and on and on and on. But what I get, the output is effectively just a JPEG, which I could have made in 3D or Photoshop comping or drawing if I was good drawing. But that's just then the effectively the sketch or the brief of making something physical. So, you know, like in our new store in Malibu, like I made the furniture with the help of AI. But without the manufacturer or the artisans who can make the furniture, it's nothing. It's just a JPEG. It's no value. But for me to be able to show them this is what we need to do, then I still have to like have help from our, you know, amazing architect and you know, the people who actually make it, of course. But you have to pick the stone and then the proportions and everything. But it's a very good initial sketch. Mm. I could do all of this before. It just took a long time and took a lot of manpower. Yeah. But now, you know, I'm working on a book that is objects of desire that was never made. That is just, you know, thousands of objects of made with AI that I've done over the last 2 years. And I find it so fascinating. And for me, that again is like creative director, ADHD, I need instant gratification. It is so rewarding. Mm. It's visually so rewarding for me. And like I give you an example. It's a lot of people also think it's like, oh, someone showed a picture that went viral that is, here's the Pope in a puffer jacket, and oh, that's AI. It's like, but I could have comped that 20 years ago in Photoshop. It's not new. Mm. It's just an idea. And now it was like handed to all of us, just like everyone is a photographer now because the iPhone is very good camera, you know. But it's not the phone. It's what you put in front of the phone. Mm. It's the access. Like Jürgen Teller, amazing photographer, shoots everything with iPhone now. But you can't be Jürgen Teller. Neither can I.
Is shooting everything with iPhone now?
So I heard, but you know, a lot.
Oh,
but
my goodness.
But it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
That's the thing. It's not the, and so many people always ask me, because I do pictures, like, what camera do you use?
What camera do you use?
No, it doesn't matter. That's the point. It doesn't matter. I use many different cameras. Okay. It's like, you know, I have a Contest G2, I shot an iPhone, Canon, Hasselblad, like, none of that matters. It's just a tool. It's what you put in front of.
Right,
or the access you have, or the taste you have, or the opinion, or the consistency of your creative expression, or the idea that you have, right?
Okay.
And the AI is the same thing to me. So the like the AI visuals I've created, so much of me in it. If you did it, it would look very different.
Of course.
My dad did it, it would look very different.
Mm. But give us a concrete example. For example, I want to make a sofa for my shop.
Yeah.
What do you say to the
Well, it depends
machine.
On different things. So like I made furniture for the new frame store in Malibu, for example, in Madison, with the help of a lot of people. But there you know, there's a stone table, and I trained specific AI models. It's not a generalistic AI.
Okay.
It's only on certain visuals, and then I work with it. So there I trained it on research I did on your stone, right? It's not a table, it's your stone.
Mm.
And then I push it with text over and over again to get to it. It could be like a brutalist table based on this stone and this reference of color, and then change and go again and go again and go again. So the table that we have is maybe, you know, iteration number 500.
Mm. This is, you are going to that kind of iteration, 500 iteration. Okay.
At least.
Okay.
And I'm very happy with this table. I think it's beautiful. And I think it's more unique than if I would have given a mood board of some reference of good furniture designers or artists. That's less unique.
Mm.
You know, I did another project. I can't make it because it's all about if you can make it or not. Like I have a country house in England, and sometimes I buy little ceramics, like not artists, not very basic ceramics locally in Wiltshire, England, from like vintage, like antique shops or whatever, cheap. So I took pictures of these ceramics, and then I trained the AI on those pictures because I like these ceramics. And then I asked it to make handbags, so not more ceramics, but handbags. And they're amazing. Now, we don't make handbags. I'm not going to make handbags. I did it for fun and for creative expression. But if I was a
bag designer, yeah.
A bag designer, or, you know, if I had a big brand that did big brands, I would definitely do this. Yeah. I've done it with frame menswear, for example. I did a, you know, sometimes it's called, you do like a style out where you bring vintage clothes and so forth, and you put together looks, and that becomes the basis of a collection or inspiration. So we did that, and then I photographed that, and then I took those pictures, trained an AI model, and then asked AI to do variations of that in different proportions and different ways. And I don't think we can apply it yet in the way it should be, but it was an interesting exercise.
But what kind of model do you use? Because we all know ChatGPT, DALL-E, etc. But what do you use? We want to have access to that.
No, you can. It's Runway. It's called runway.ml. He's the next guy you should interview, I think.
Okay.
The founder, Cristobal.
It's accessible to everybody?
Yeah, 100%. Okay. What is my choice? And there's, I mean, again, AI is developing so fast. So I started using this a while ago. Now there's so many different kinds.
Mm.
And it goes so fast. So even I, you know, because I have a day job, and this is what I do.
At night.
At night, yeah. But AI can work when you go to bed too, which is amazing.
Yeah.
But I love what they did. And Cristobal, who is one of the founders, is from Venezuela, who I then got the pleasure of meeting and knowing, and we have lunch sometimes. And it's incredible what they're about to do and what they're doing. Also because he, you know, he went to Tisch, like he's more an artistic person rather than a computer engineer. And then they made this. And therefore, it's like it's very leaning into our world more.
More sensitive.
Yeah. It doesn't need code. It's like, and I can make specific models, which for me has worked out. But I think it's very different to what everyone uses and what it works for them. But I made a point out of learning this in a deep way and pushing it in a deep way. And then the pleasure of now knowing him and being able to know a little bit more and learn more, and I think it's interesting to be at the, it's important to embrace the newness of everything.
But how do you embrace things? How do you learn new things?
I'm curious. You have to be curious.
Yeah.
If you're creative, if you're not curious, you're over.
Yeah.
And if you think, I always say, it's like if you think you're all that, if you think you've done it, like you're done. Like it's over.
You're dead.
I think I'm nobody. I've done nothing. Mm. Must continue. Right? And that's why. No, but it's
not so simple. But
yeah.
It's,
but you're at the Ritz, huh? This is, isn't it like a. No. I mean, whatever.
Yeah, but it's not about. Yeah, this is a fancy hotel room. You know, I work hard, of course, with companies. Mm. And of course, I'm very privileged. But it's not what I work for.
Mm. What do you work for?
I want to get more creative results and do new things. It's like I'm working now and like, you know, like doing this, being part of doing this furniture for the store is very exciting for me.
Yeah. But are you gonna sell them at some point?
No.
Just for fun and just for the frame store. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, but it's like you're exploring. Mm. Now I'm like flirting with this. I'm learning.
Yeah.
But maybe in 5 years, I don't know.
Why not? I heard that you are making some art pieces as well.
I make some stuff for myself. But again, no one will maybe never see this.
Mm.
This is, again, just like starting to learn about myself a little bit more. It might turn into something, as you say, like it might, as I said, like what is a good project or not, like it might be sticky, it might not be. As I said earlier, things that I'm interested in, I want to be part of or make, you know, you can be an observer, but I want to make. So like, you know, obsessed with sculptures and furniture, and so I want to make some, I have my own ideas.
It seems that you are very talented when it comes to interaction with the people. You are, I feel very,
I like people.
No, you like people. I feel very at ease. You welcome me in your room.
Of course.
You are talking with everybody in the fashion industry, etc. So you are very good at making relationship with the people. How do you make it?
I don't know. I mean, I hope so. Thank you. That sounds good.
That's second nature. No, I mean,
I think
you care about the people.
I do. I love people. I want to be generous, you know? I don't like when people are rude or too pretentious, or there's space for everyone and it's nice to. And maybe I also have a personality where I'm also very insecure, so I want to be liked. You know?
Yeah.
No, I'm deeply insecure, which most creatives are at one point, and often if they don't behave that way, it's because it's just a defense. And I know when I react badly, for example, you know, it's because I'm insecure. Mm. But I do think it's not a great answer, and neither is it a great quality potentially, but like I want to be liked. I don't like conflict. I don't want people to...
You don't like conflict.
But I'm also very curious. Like I like to hear and learn about, I think, people and what they're doing and how they're doing it. And like you have a podcast. You're curious, right?
Yeah.
And I think that's rewarding. And I think it's like an exchange of energy. It's like, I think I can give a lot of energy. And if I get it back, it's fantastic. Sometimes it's exhausting if you people don't give you back.
But at some point you get something back. What does your days look like? I mean, and what I want to understand, that's my question behind this question, is managing so many projects at the same time, how don't you get distracted, you know?
I do. It's all I am is distracted. This is the problem.
This is a problem. No, but speaking for myself, I've got this podcast and I want to do something big with this podcast, but I've got my brand as well. And you need to manage your family. I've got a baby. Yeah.
Oh, amazing.
Et cetera, et cetera. So it's sometimes overwhelming, you know, you want to do everything perfectly and you are ambitious for all your projects. But how do you stay focused? You're not focused. You're going to tell me.
Yeah. I can tell you that. It's almost the same every day. No, it's not, but... My day is get up and get my son ready to school.
5, 6, 7?
He's 6 years old, but I don't get up at 5. No. I get up at 6:45 or 7, get him out to school, and then I try to work out because I'm now older. It seems to be important. I have a German trainer, Dennis.
Who's the, for 1 hour?
Yep.
Every day, yeah.
Like, no, not every day. Then I would look much better than this. 3 to 4 times a week. But that's like a regular day. And then, depending on the day, I try to do this like office days and then external days. So I try to concentrate for it to be effective. We have an office in New York where I live. And there's no typical day, of course, but it's... if it's office day, I try to stay in the office and just do my work and Zoom calls and meetings that are internal. Or I do a day when I try to concentrate external meetings. That means, you know, interviews with people you want to hire or new opportunities or connections and whatnot when I'm in New York. But that's like the basic day. And then I go home, or there might be some dinner or something, but I go home and eat with the family and watch Netflix. And then it's another day. I mean, it's pretty regular that way. But then, of course... There's no regular day. The day can also be Miami to shoot Giselle, or I'm in LA for a week to do proto or board meetings. And this is kind of what works and doesn't work for me. Ideally, I think it'd be good to have more regular days, but without the irregular days, I would get too bored. But I try to make up time to always have enough time to do some newness in like meeting new people or new talent or whatever that might be. But then I also need solid time to do creative work. It's not something, you know, you jump on for 30 minutes and you're supposed to just have it, right? It can take a day, it can take 2 days before it comes to you, what you're going to do. So it's a very mixed bag, but I try to have some rigor in the scheduling.
But is there, you are still operational into Saturday and...
No. We sold all that.
Okay.
No, nothing like that.
But Wednesday.
No, we sold all that.
You sold everything?
Many, many years ago. Yeah.
Okay,
yeah,
sorry.
We sold all of that.
This is only frame and and frame.
Yeah. So, yeah, my day-to-day is frame.
Okay.
Then there's other things that come up, of course, involved in other things here and there.
But you're going to get bored, no? If you do only frame.
Yeah, but I don't.
You don't? Okay.
No. I'm not bored with frame. I love frame. I'm weirdly consistent. Remember, it's like in my career, I've had 3 jobs. I worked at Wink for Tyler. Me and Jan set up Saturday Group. That became Saturday Group. That was a long time. And then we set up Frame. And that's it. So even there might be other like things happening, projects and whatever. But I'm actually very consistent and very loyal. Like in that way, I'm very consistent, very loyal, you know, long project. I don't get bored that easily in that. But within the project, new things have to happen. And you have to bring energy to the brand and energy to the people. And I think that's also a big part of my job is to energize the team or excite the team or whoever, whichever team it is in that sense.
Okay. When you interview somebody, what kind of question do you ask them?
How can we make you happy? And what are your dreams?
That's the main question.
To hire someone, yes. I think, and I'm not a very good interviewer, so... I did it today actually, but I think it's important to, and like CVs, I don't care so much about. I just like a conversation and the person, and then I think it's important to see, and I wish they think the same, you know, about the company if they come and work for us. Like, how can they make us happy and realize our dreams? But I think it's important if you can share an idea about what you want to achieve and what you want to do. Usually, it's quite successful collaboration.
What makes a good product? I mean, you looks like you are very into product as well.
Yeah, I think a good product has to have integrity and opinion, which is, I guess, similar, and at times deliver a solution. And a solution can be very different. Solution can be to look sexy or look in a certain way or feel in a certain way. If it's close, a solution can be an iPhone, you know. I think that's good. And I think a perceived value is important, which means with Frame, for example, I like that we have an elastic price point. We can have a jean for $250. If that's a good fabric and it makes you feel good, that's good value. I have a leather trench coat for $4,500. But that other brand says $20,000. We don't have the brand value maybe of that other brand, but it's a good leather trench coat. And we sell out all the time with this. So the perceived value is good. It's like honest. And I think brands and product, if they're honest, are good.
Good products, good brands. I want to come back to photography. You are a photographer.
Well, I'm a creative director that takes pictures.
That's different.
Yeah.
Or to make a good picture, or to make a good image. For example, coming back on the last campaign you shoot, I mean, the last campaign we are seeing now on the media with Giselle. What was the idea behind and how you worked to that, to access this picture, I mean, to make this picture, sorry.
Oh, yeah, it's a good question.
What has been the creative process?
Well, this is an interesting question because I thought about this a lot, actually, in my career. Because I've had different scenarios where, you know, being art director, you hire good photographers and then you hope that it's going to be good, which sometimes it is, to trying to do it yourself. And I will say, like, you know, I like taking pictures. It suits my personality and so forth. But I am a creative director that takes pictures, not a photographer in that sense. And this out of respect of photographers, I really respect amazing photographers, right? Because I don't, you know, I don't have a unique expression in the pictures. I do it. This is a solution. But when you start your own brand, it's also like you don't have any money and stuff. So, of course, if I could work with Steve Meisel all the time or, you know, some of my heroes, I would. But it's not just possible. So it's a necessity at some point. But I like it. But what I've learned, if anything, and I can tell you about the Giselle thing, but is it really is what you put in front of the camera. As I said before, it's not about the camera. It doesn't even have to be about the light that much. It really is like how you put it together. You know, what's the like, does it make sense? Like, what's the clothes? What's the person? What's the hair? What's the makeup? Again, it's like a team effort. And if you can, have a team and then everyone is on the same page to do something that is believable to that person, I think it can be a nice picture, a good picture. And this took me a long time to even understand. At the times, when I was younger, I was hoping for the best.
Yeah. What I want to understand is, I mean, the whole process when you start to think about this new campaign, what is the purpose of this campaign? What was the purpose of this campaign? Why you choose Giselle and why you choose this setup and why you choose to take the picture like that?
Yeah.
And this is what I want to understand.
Here's a very frustrating answer for you. No. Giselle, important because I think she embodies the frame woman. Mm-hmm. Very well, and I've known her for a long time, and you know, it was the second campaign we did with her, so that was like a no-brainer. I think she's embodies what we want to stand for. She's like strong, amazing, sexy, obviously beautiful, but like she's more than just that. And I think, you know, she's not an 18-year-old model, she's a woman. You know,
I think she means something.
And I think other women likes her, and I like that, and so it felt true. The other part, the thing though with those pictures is, and this is why it's, I think, good or how it works, is that because I am the photographer and the client and the creative director on set, we can move very fast and kind of do what we want. So actually in the day when we shot Giselle, I shoot four different setups, not just one. So we built one set because I wanted like denim to be in bed and sort of like look like the boyfriend took the picture. But then saying that, because we don't have an agency and we don't have like lots of opinions, you can be very fast and very easy. So like I planned one light and then I was like, I don't like it, I change. I don't have to ask any permission. And then Giselle likes it, like it, we go, boom, done. It's like the campaign picture was the second frame. Move on. This I love.
Mm.
This is, having been an art director for so many years, I now understand that mostly I was probably just in the way.
Mm.
Like now I prefer like the best pictures. Like I've done these projects where I send a box of clothes to a photographer that is not me and go, shoot it how you like and send it back to me. It's mm-hmm. always amazing.
Mm.
You know, we publish books like this with like Lambeti, Louis Weber, Chris Coles. And I prefer it. I think it's better when you work with someone, you should work with them for what they're going to do.
Mm.
So if I work with other photographers, I don't want to control them so much, you know. And the same thing here. We want to like be honest. And when it's good, it's good.
Mm. I'm taking the picture as well for my brand.
Great.
And one thing I'm struggling is the light. How did you manage the light? Because I'm always doing, you know, natural light, so it's getting it's easier for me.
Yeah.
But at some point, I would like to manage a little bit more the studio light. How did you go through this process?
It's very simple. You hire a first assistant who knows what they're doing. I have no idea how to set up the lights.
Okay.
To this date. I think a lot of photographers don't, but and then the other thing I think is that I always say is that, again, it's like to be honest with what it is. I always tell the team, even, it's like, don't try to make, you know, let's say for frame, you know, we don't have like complicated styling, we don't have gala dresses or whatever it might be. If they do something without me, I said, don't try to make this look like a Steven Meisel picture. It won't. So like, let that be it. Be honest about it. Like maybe it's better to shoot with a point-and-shoot camera or a Polaroid or your iPhone, and that would look cooler because it's honest in that way. I think often when people try to make...
And pretend what would they are not.
But it's not. It is really bad. And even with my pictures, I never try to pretend to make it complicated, you know? It's better, and that's like we shoot a lot with this, like context on, you know, on camera flash, straight on, kind of honest. You know, it's on film. I don't retouch the pictures, really. It's honest. I like that. Or it's, you know, if you want to shoot in studios, you know, the light effectively can come from the front, the side, or at the side, or from the back, kind of. I'm simplifying it. But I think it's important to be, like, honest. It's like with products. Like, what is it? Am I allowed to do it? A jean is a jean is a jean. So don't try to take a picture of a jean and try to make it look like a short, you know, picture. So I think it's more that, like, what is right for this moment and this product and this
whatever, what sounds right,
woman,
yeah,
you want to think. So, like, you know, if you, a pair of jeans and Giselle is like rolling around in bed, like looks like a boyfriend took the picture, like I believe it. If I try to like do like complicated big hair and crazy makeup in a pair of jeans, I don't believe it, you know? And this, I think, is for that's me at least is important. I mean, and I like simple things anyway, but try that.
I will do.
Or get a good first assistant.
Good first assistant and a good model.
Always good model.
Always good model.
Can't fix that.
If you had to start over again today, what would you do?
The same. Maybe. Yeah. I don't know. I think I had a good life. It's good.
So far, so
good. Maybe I would have worked for one more really incredible person that was more like more of a creative director, like more of a visual, you know, but that would have been good, maybe, to learn a different kind of rigor. I had to learn a lot myself. And I would have maybe been in New York earlier.
Really?
Yeah.
Why?
I think it was a big opportunity. Maybe we set up the agency in London. We could have done it in New York. Maybe it would have been even more faster, more relevant, maybe. But no, I think I'm pretty good, I think.
Yeah. If you had, it's not a fun question, but I think it's interesting. If you had 3 years to live, what would you do?
Oh my God. You have a panic attack. I would solely focus on my loved ones, obviously. Mm. You know, my Natalie, my much better half, you know, my son Jet and Isabella and Ava, my stepdaughters. And I mean, my parents, for sure. That must be the priority. And then try to outlive the 3 years.
Yeah, of course.
Oh my God.
Sorry.
No, don't be sorry. It's okay. But I never thought about that. I would probably panic.
Yeah, yeah. It's panicking, of course. Do you have any other tricks or tools you use on a daily basis except AI? AI looks, it's been a very game changer.
I have a good one.
Yeah.
I've told this many times because I do so much like image research in my career and previously, which this is, I think this is such a hack. There is a software called 4K Stogram. It's a strange name. But you have it on your laptop. It pulls down, you know, on Instagram, when you save it, you save images. It goes into some folder. It's hard to extract. It saves all that down to you, a folder on your laptop. So for me, who's, you know, I run around a lot or whatever, you're in a taxi or something and you do research and let's say I look at furniture and here's you save. So I save all the time. So I'm always just like researching. Mm. It's 5 minutes. And then I just put in everything I like or feel something for, gets pulled into a folder, saved down to your laptop. And then in the JPEGs, this is very, I know it's very like matter of fact and also strategic. But so every time I start a new project, I go to this folder, it's everything I save and I like. Then I go, okay, so what resonates with me again when I think about this project or this idea, let's say. So I never start researching. It's always there. Mm. It's always ongoing.
Interesting.
This has been very good.
That's a nice one. Perfect.
No, I mean, it's like a very simple thing. It's like a small software, yeah. But it really saves you hours and days.
Of course.
And then you're constantly like activating like what's your taste anyway. So I have stuff in there that is, yeah, it's like furniture, art, whatnot.
So cool.
I think it's kind of cool. And then...
All right. Is there anything you wanted to talk about that we don't talk about?
No, we really talked a lot.
Yeah.
No, but it's nice. But no, I don't think so.
That was nice, no? And my last question is, I always ask this question, is who would you like to listen to in this podcast? Who is my next guest, to rephrase it?
I already told you. Cristobal from Runway. He's a curveball for you. I'll make the introduction, but yeah. I think what they do with also with film and stuff would be very interesting for people to hear.
Perfect. Let's do that. Thank you so much, Eric. It was so cool tonight to talk to you.
Thank you very much.
You take care.
Good therapy session.
I'm gonna send you the bill.
Okay. Ciao.
My name is Adrien Garcia, and you've just listened to The Bold Way. Find this episode in text and pictures at theboldway.fr. The Bold Way is where creativity and innovation meets business. Thank you for your trust, and see you soon for a new episode.